But who do you think looked after me when I was living in the jungle and climbed around the trees which were a lot higher so that I could watch the animals? Where were you then? I don't know where I was then, but now I'm here and you have to obey. I answered emphatically. He wasn't pleased at all, but as I gave him plenty of freedom in other respects, he soon found other occupations and the matter was forgotten. Some time later he came home from school in complete exasperation. Ridiculous! He exploded. The priest was trying to make us believe that people live only once. But I know that people live more than once. I know it. But it's best not to try to talk to grown-ups. A fellow just has to keep his mouth shut. The impressions of this life had probably displaced the memories in his consciousness, and for a long time he made no further mention of these matters. When he was about 15, he asked us to buy him a big jazz drum. Together we went to the best music shop in town, and he picked out the biggest drum in sight with all its trappings. Then the miraculous experience we had had when he first tried to row was repeated again. As soon as he had the drum in the house, he took the two drumsticks, sat down beside it and started playing the most difficult rhythms and the most impossible syncopations, all with a perfectly sure hand and complete self-confidence. He played ecstatically, his eyes beaming and tears rolling down his cheeks. He said nothing about how he came to be able to play a drum. Only once, as he was playing a very peculiar rhythm, he remarked, "Hear that, Mum? That's how we used to signal each other and pass on messages across tremendous distances." And he went on drumming like one possessed. He was never interested in reading stories about Negro life. "Why should I?" he asked. "I know better than books can tell me what life was like there. Why should I care what white people have written about it? And when I read real true descriptions, I always start to cry, even when I try not to." Even as a grown-up young officer in the Air Force, seeing a Negro cinema film always moved him to tears. Sitting there, in the darkness, he would cry like a baby, although silently, with big salty tears streaming down his cheeks. Where had he learned to play the drum? How hard it is I learned myself when I once tried it. How does a city child come to want to own a drum? And why should a happy, up-to-date young man burst into tears when he plays a drum or sees Negro films? Years later, Paul Brunton paid us a visit when he was returning to Europe from India. I told him about my son's memories. He asked to see the drawings. After examining them attentively, he said, "This kind of hut is typical of a particular tribe living on the banks of the Zambezi in Central Africa. He has drawn it correctly in every detail." "Yes, but this hat isn't an African native's hat. It looks just like a civilized man's hat made of felt," I said. Brunton smiled. "No, you're mistaken. The child is right. The hat is indeed typical of this tribe. Only it's not made of felt, but of bulrushes plaited together. His hunting weapon is correctly drawn too. And the monster that bites off people's legs is a crocodile, of course. There are many of them there. But tell me how you came to attract a Negro as your child?" he asked finally. "I don't know how to answer that one," I replied. Then we both smiled and talked about other things. This all happened several years later. My son's first memories came that summer at the lake shore when the little black beetle attracted his attention and he stopped playing to watch it for a long, long time. Without knowing it, he used an Indian method to achieve great concentration. Indian yogis do it by staring for a long time at a black spot on the wall, or at a crystal ball. Unknowingly, the child did the same, for the little black beetle was like a black spot, and the boy probably fell into a trance quite unintentionally. Thus the memory of a previous incarnation came to life within him. The summer went by and my condition improved. My consciousness was clear again, and I no longer saw the world in such a hazy fashion. The burning sensation in my blood also stopped. But in the autumn, after I returned to the city, I began to have the same symptoms as the many women who had died from their horse serum vaccinations. I had to go back to bed again, suffering from terrible cramps and pains. I never would have believed that a human being can endure such torture without dying. I completely lost control of my body, just as if my nerves had been quite paralyzed. When I wanted to raise my hand did not budge. It was a terrifying condition. And in my sleepless nights, I heard an ugly, repugnant voice drowning out the roaring in my ears, "So you think you can catch me?" Ha ha ha. The doctors consulted each other again and advised an operation. That same evening we had a telephone call from one of my husband's boyhood friends with whom we had kept in close touch. He had just returned from a sojourn of many years in India. The next day he came by to pay us a visit. Seeing me in such miserable shape, he said, "You know, while I was in India I spent a lot of time learning yoga under a great master. If you follow my advice and do as I say, you will get well again. Under no circumstances should you submit to an operation." I promised to do whatever he told me to. He then showed me a few simple breathing exercises which I could do as I lay there in bed only half alive. He told me I should practice them often during the day, and in doing them I was to guide and control my consciousness. I followed his instructions to the letter. Within a few days' time my condition was considerably better. The pains were abating, and all my other symptoms showed a surprising change for the better. Within 2 weeks I was so much improved that I could even stand up for a few minutes at a time. I became myself again. I still felt minor disturbances, but our friends showed me some more yoga exercises, and I kept on improving. By the time spring came around, I was strong enough to travel to the seashore to spend a few months convalescing. That blessed climate, combined with the salt water bathing and yoga exercises, gave me back my health. During my last 4 weeks there, my husband was with me and I experienced the most beautiful period of my personal life. Only one who has been hopelessly sick and then recovered knows what it means to be well again. Oh, thou unknown strength and power people call God. I thank thee that thou hast given me back my health, that thou hast permitted me to escape from hell, that thou hast enabled me to avoid becoming a burden upon my loved ones. Enabled me to become a useful working human being again. The sun had never been so beautiful, nor the sky so blue, nor the sea so sparkling as that summer. When autumn came, we went home, and soon I was back at work in my studio. One evening we all went to the cinema together. The program consisted of a number of Walt Disney films, and we got an immense amount of fun out of watching Mickey Mouse, Pluto and Donald Duck. Then came a film in which all three of these animals teamed up and founded a firm to drive the ghosts and spooks out of haunted houses. They advertised their service in the newspaper, and their advertisement came to the attention of one of a number of ghosts who were living together in an old castle. He straightway summoned all the other ghosts and spooks and goblins, and indignantly read the notice to them. Incensed at the idea that even ghosts would no longer be able to live in peace, they all consulted together and decided they would teach the people in this new firm a lesson. One of them called up the firm and asked to have a man sent over. Then the head ghost assigned a specific task to each of the many spooks assembled. One was to hide behind the door, another under the bed, another inside the mirror so that anyone looking at it would see a ghost instead of himself, all with the idea of giving the people in Mickey and Company such a terrible scare they would be glad to give up their plan. When the jobs were all assigned, the chief spook gave a signal and all his cronies disappeared by simply rolling up into greenish phosphorescent balls which rolled away, gliding and hopping, and disappeared in different directions, laughing fiendishly at the idea that earthly creatures should think of trying to catch them. I became stiff with amazement. My younger sister and brother began to call out, "Look, look! Esther's green ball! Just look at that!" They were so excited and so loud in their comments, I thought for a little while the ushers were going to throw us out of the house. They could not have known, no one could have that the entire scene, as the chief spook himself rolled up into a greenish ball, laughed fiendishly and hopped away, was just exactly the way I had seen it long, long before. I was thoroughly shaken. Could it really be that other people saw these manifestations too? I did not doubt for a moment that Walt Disney had actually seen such a greenish ball. Or how could he have come to invent, out of pure imagination, a sequence matching with exquisite precision exactly what I had seen long, long before? It was absolutely too much to suppose that this was pure coincidence. But that was not all. A few weeks later I received a book entitled, Aram Magic and Mysticism. It was a large collection of authentic documents. After reading about a number of phenomena, I came to the following quotation, apostrophe. How should this somebody come through a door that was locked and bolted? Knowing full well that the door was firmly locked, I thought, nobody can get in here. Even if the door knob is turned and the door made a noise. But what was that? There was a rustling sound in the room, a rapping sound in the wardrobe. It came over to my bed and made its presence known by rapping on my bedstead, then went past my bed and tinkled on the glass of a lamp on my night table. And a bit further on, I saw nothing, and I did not particularly try to see anything. Only the person in the next room claims to have seen, on the floor of my room, a light about the size of the full moon. He claims to have seen clearly how this rolling ball of light appeared in the doorway and disappeared behind the wall. I could scarcely believe my eyes. Was I meeting this full moon-like ball of light again? Apparently this ball of light is not such a rare thing. How strange. With a little reflection, we can find an analogous example in electricity, the ball of lightning. This ball also seems to roll through the air. There are reports recording how such balls of lightning have bounced into a room through a window, rolled across the room and out of another open window without doing any damage. As long as the lightning stays rolled up in a ball, there is no danger, but when it emerges from this spherical form, it destroys everything in its path. In this latter case, a ball of lightning is a thousand times more dangerous than ordinary lightning. What then is this greenish phosphorescent ball which can do such catastrophic damage, if not a ball of lightning, only on another plane? Handed down to us from incredibly ancient times, there is this saying attributed to an outstandingly great initiate, Hermes Trismegistos, who was said to know all the secrets of heaven and earth, as above, so below, as below, so above. What a remarkable parallel phenomenon, this green ball and the ball of lightning. The Ayurvedas. I was working again every day in my studio. Once while I was working, I was suddenly overcome by unbearable restlessness. I felt as if I were really doing nothing. Time was rushing by madly with giant strides. Days were going by, each like the one before, and I was doing nothing. Nothing? How come I am doing nothing? I asked myself. I am working all day long, studying and reading a whole library of books. When I am tired, I play the piano. Why should I feel I am doing nothing? I thought back about the last few years and heard an answer within me, you've done nothing, absolutely nothing, to alleviate the sufferings of others. Being a wife, a mother, a sculptress, all these things are purely personal matters. That was true, but what could I have done? For several years I had been waiting for higher powers to give me an order about what I should do. I had never once heard the voice. How am I to know what kind of work I am to do? I asked myself. When I think back, now as I am telling this, and call up to mind the person I was then, I simply have to smile. How naive is the human being, the unknowing person? How could anyone be a co-worker in the great plan if he has not yet reached the goal himself? If he has not been able to conquer himself? But every person who awakens and sees the goal of life goes through the growing pains of wanting to save humanity instead of first saving himself. The higher powers actually do see to it that every neophyte is cured of this naive idea. At that time, however, I was not yet cured and was bent on making people happy. Ever since I had taken my vow, I never forgot for a moment that that's what I was living for. Various temptations which might have been real temptations for other people or for me early in my life, no longer presented any problems. There were men enough who wanted to satisfy their desire for pleasure. They said they loved me. I saw quite clearly, however, that they did not even notice me, the being I am in reality. They simply wanted physical love. How could that have interested me after I had once looked into nature's trap? Such desires were not even flattering for my vanity. On the contrary, I found it degrading that men, again and again, coveted my body. When the conversation was ranging over profound philosophical themes, the man with whom I was talking and who claimed to be a friend, was enthusiastic about my intelligence, but at the first opportunity he wanted to kiss me. Did he perhaps want to kiss my intelligence? Another was enthusiastic about my musical ability. When I played the piano for a group of friends, he said he was a music worshipper. Kissing my hand, he looked deep into my eyes. But with what sensuality? I was already acquainted with such music worship and laughed at him. How boring, how boring. I really was attracted by music, philosophy and psychology, in fact by all kinds of art and science, but I had to learn again and again that most philosophers, psychologists, astronomers, scientists, artists, just like other men, considered sex much more interesting. The poor boys. What will they have left when they someday lose their masculinity? Emptiness, their own terrible emptiness. And these men wanted to convince me that I was wasting my life because I did not want to taste sexual pleasures at every opportunity. How debasing! Can men only see sex? Can they not simply be human beings over and above the level of sex? Like children who play together for the fun of playing and not because the game concerns sex in any way. Many people go in for music, art, theater and psychology only in order to be able to conquer new partners one after the other. The Bible says, "If ye are not like unto little children, verily I say unto you, ye shall not enter into the kingdom of heaven." The tremendous depth of this wonderful saying became really apparent to me when I saw the unrest and dissatisfaction of the people who live only for sex, and these poor, empty people, when they noticed my indifference, thought I was inhibiting my natural urges or simply pretending. I always analyzed myself very strictly, and I never had a thought which would have attracted me to a man. I loved my husband just as much as ever, but no longer as a woman loving a man, but as one human being loving another. It was no temptation, no struggle, and no victory over my desires, for I simply had no desire for a man. Ever since the night when I had clearly recognized the deceit of physical love, I had no longer felt myself to be a woman. In that night I became a human being, a self, and the self has no desire for sex. The self is without sex. The self is not a half of something seeking its complementary half, the self is a complete whole, and when a person recognizes this truth, the body follows. As I cogitated on these things there in my studio, I suddenly had the same feeling I had had years before when practicing thought transmission and when unable to pick up and carry out another's thought. I felt such a weight on my chest that I could scarcely breathe. Putting down my modeling tools, I tried to concentrate. Then, just as I had felt it years before, I felt the strange prickling sensation throughout my whole body, and again I heard the well-known voice which had been silent for so long, the blessed voice, "Why are you neglecting your spiritual abilities?" "How shall I not neglect them? What can I do about them?" I asked back. "You know very well that merely being born with a talent for music, sculpture or other arts does not mean by any manner of means that a person is an artist. He must develop his talent, and to do that he must practice, practice, and practice some more. Talent without diligence and diligence without talent is not art. But if you combine your talent with diligence, that is real art. You have talents which you simply allow to lie idle, the ability to express this spirit. Practice, practice, practice. And you will become an artist in the kingly art which stands above all other art, in the artless art." My heart began to beat fast. For years I had been waiting for an inner order as to what I should do. I had never received an answer. There was nothing else for me to do but keep on working and fulfilling the daily duties that life demanded of me. I learned psychology and sculpturing. These two studies supplemented each other wonderfully. When I was working on a bust, I delved deep into the psychology of my model. I found all people simply fascinating, and the more profoundly I was able to penetrate into their psychology, the better my heads turned out. I began to realize that a portrait and psychological analysis are one and the same kind of work. In making a bust of a person, I had to be simultaneously giving him psychological advice, and everyone whom I have ever modeled has remained spiritually very close to me. My monumental works and large compositions were also a great source of pleasure to me. The concentration opened ever new doors to ever new vistas of truth. But in the depths of my soul, I was sorry not to be hearing the voice anymore. I was as dry as sawdust, feeling that I had lost contact with some power coming from a very high source. Now this source was re-established and the voice was telling me that I should practice the artless art. How should I practice it? Is there such a thing as an appropriate form of exercise? If there is, I never heard of it. Once again and very clearly I heard the voice within me, "Seek." "Seek? Where? And how?" I asked. There was no answer. That evening we were invited over to the home of our friend who, when I was dying, had saved my life by teaching me yoga exercises and how to guide my consciousness. We were a jolly group. The men freshened up their schoolday memories, and I amused myself by looking at our friend's library. One book in particular attracted me very much, and I asked whether I might take it home. "Of course," said our friend. I took the book and sat down to talk with the men. I asked our friend to tell us how and where he had learned these yoga exercises, with which he had healed me. He told us that he had once been invited by an Indian Maharaja to go tiger hunting. During the hunt, his horse suddenly shied and threw him out of the saddle in such a very unfortunate way that he fell on his back and was not able to get up. He was carried back to his room. The Maharaja visited him and asked him which of his two physicians he should send, the English or the Indian. Our friend asked for the English physician. The latter prescribed various sedatives and pain-killing drugs, and advised him to stay in bed. Days went by, weeks went by, and he was still lying helpless, unable to get up, unable even to move his neck or back. At the end of 6 weeks, he was still getting worse. The Maharaja came to visit him again. "You asked for the English physician," he said, "and I sent him to you. He has been treating you for 6 weeks, but your condition has only been getting worse. I suggest you ask the advice of my Indian physician, my Ayurvedic practitioner. He could help you." Our friend asked the Maharaja to send him at once. "What is an Ayurvedic practitioner?" I asked. "It is a person who is initiated into and acquainted with the Ayurveda," our friend replied. "The Vedas are the holy books of the Indians, the highest philosophy on earth. They are made up of various parts. The Ayurveda is the science of health. It contains all the secrets of the human body, diseases, methods of healing and maintenance of health. As early as 5,000 to 6,000 years ago, these initiates had developed operative techniques for replacing injured organs of the body with healthy organs removed from corpses. They were able to perform the most unbelievable operations. They were able to replace a blind eye with a healthy one, both in animals and humans, and they were even able to replace an entire leg. They also knew that diseases were caused by myriads of tiny invisible creatures which today we call bacteria. They also regarded bacteria as the cells of the invisible body of a demonic spirit, whereas Western scientists, with the exception of a few initiates like Paracelsus, have never made an attempt at research in this field. The evil spirit takes possession of one or more persons, invades the person with his body, and when this person's vibrations coincide with those of the evil spirit, he becomes sick. However, there are always persons whose vibrations are different from those of the demon. These persons do not become sick. In the terms of Western science, they are immune. In the holy books of India, all these disease spirits are thoroughly described as to their appearance and even shown in colored pictures. They are horrible figures, each with its characteristic appearance and color. The demon of the plague, for example, is a black monster, and you will recall that the plague is also called the Black Death. The spirit of another equally fatal disease is a yellow demon, and the disease he causes is known as yellow fever. The spirit of leprosy has a lion-like head, and you perhaps know that lepers can be recognized from quite a distance by the lion-like appearance of their faces. Through the face of the leper, one can see and recognize the lion face of the spirit by which he is possessed. Pneumonia is caused by a gigantic red demon represented as consisting of fire and flame. And so it goes. Each disease is ascribed to a person's being possessed by a certain specific demon. Just a moment, I interrupted. What did you say? Pneumonia comes from a gigantic red demon? How interesting. And a childhood memory suddenly came to light again before my eyes. Again I saw my little brother jumping up high bed, looking off in one direction of the room with his eyes bulging, and screaming at the top of his lungs, "Mother, mother, the red man is coming to get me. Mother, help." And I can still see how he waved his little hands as if trying to ward off an invisible enemy. Then he fainted, and mother said, "What he sees is nothing real, he's having an hallucination." But I saw at the time it happened that this red man represented reality for the child. Apparently it was an objective reality, as the Indians already knew several thousand years ago. For reality is not only what we can grasp with our hands and see with our eyes. I told him about this experience I had had as a child, but our friend was not surprised. The sick often see these demons at the moment they become possessed by them. Sometimes later too, during the sickness when they are fighting with the demon. Whenever they mention this, however, people merely say they have fever and are seeing things. No one ever seems to consider the origin of these pictures in the imagination of the diseased, as the persons have never thought about such things, nor why persons suffering from the same disease always see the same pictures without ever having spoken to each other, or even having met and known each other. Then our friend went on with his story about the Maharaja's Ayurvedic physician. He was a rather young Indian, friendly and well-bred, who later became a close friend with whom he was still corresponding. After investigating his nervous reflexes, the young Indian physician went away and brought back pills, ordering him to take 3 a day. On parting, the young Indian doctor smiled and said, "In 3 days you'll be riding again." Our friend sighed in disbelief. The next morning he was able to move his head. Then the Indian physician came again, gave him some more pills and had him do a few breathing exercises combined with guidance of consciousness. The next afternoon he was able to sit up and felt a prickling sensation in his spinal column as if new vital force were flowing into it. On the second day he was able to get up, walked a few steps in the room, ate his lunch with a ravenous appetite, and later went down to the garden. On the third day, after waking up fresh and full of pep, he went out for a ride. As the friendship between the two men grew, he once asked the Indian physician what he had given him to heal him so miraculously. "Our science is handed down from father to son," said the Indian. "When a son is initiated into this science, he must first make a solemn vow that he will never, under any circumstances, betray these secrets. No one has ever yet broken this oath. I cannot tell you the secret of these pills, but I can tell you a few things about our science. The pills I gave you represent a chemical compound consisting mainly of gold. This gold compound, however, is not merely so much inert matter. On the contrary, we might even call it living gold. In its preparation, it was kept at a constant moderate temperature in a hermetically sealed crucible for several weeks. Through this process, special properties connected with life are developed in the gold. You know that if you keep an egg at a constant temperature of 104 degrees for 21 days, it will hatch out in a living chick. On the other hand, If you subject the egg to a temperature of 212 degrees for 10 minutes, the egg will harden but never become a chicken. That is just exactly what happens with this gold preparation.